Hello and welcome to the ongoing summer holiday. That is the Guardian Film Show, bouncing between different venues and occasionally scratching ourselves on the scenery. One day, God willing, we shall find our way back home. Until then, we're travelling from movie to movie like a happy hobo with a bucket full of popcorn. Coming up on this week's show, Jean-Pierre Jeunet rides the boxcars through America in the young and prodigious T.S. Spivitt. Colin Firth and Reese Witherspoon unpick a backwoods murder in the fact-based Devil's Knot. And we go galloping across Iceland in the antic freestyle of horses and men. But we begin with Belle, a British period drama with a difference, the difference being the character of Belle herself, the mixed-race daughter of the white-bred landed gentry.
May I present the second of my two nieces, Miss Dido Lindsay.
I find her repulsive.
Papa, how may I be too high in rank to dine with the servants and too low to dine with my family?
Director Amar Asante tells the true-ish story of Dido Elizabeth Belle, her mother a slave and her father a sea captain. And here she is in 18th century England, mentored by great-uncle Tom Wilkinson and navigating a world of country piles and callow young suitors.
Do you love her?
As though she were created of you and me.
What of your mother?
I know very little of her other than the colour she has given me.
Then at least you know she was beautiful.
Joining me in the drawing room is Peter Bradshaw and Andrew Pulver. Peter, I guess race has been the great absent guest in most British period dramas.
Yes, it has. The other absent guest, I suspect, here a little bit is class, actually, because the story of Belle is a subject which concerns race and class. But I did quite like this. I thought it was very trad and very straightforward, but it was an interesting story. I think it's a story that, in a way, if you do it fairly straight, and Amar Asante has done it very straight, I mean, this is real Sunday tea time stuff, I think, it's pretty watchable just because the story itself is so unusual and commanding and startling in a way, and it does compel a certain amount of interest. As far as I can see, the ending of her story is what's been fictionalised, right. And it has created a kind of pseudo Jane Austen happy ending where none really existed in real life. I don't think her Belle's real life story was unhappy in that sense, other than in the general sense that the film addresses.
Yeah. It's not Pocahontas.
No, it's not. Yes, exactly. The Pocahontas, the idea of the outsider, an exotic princess who is indulged because she is so unusual, that's quite an interesting, it's certainly admissible as a point of view. But there's nothing very radical being done here. Mm. I mean, certainly when we've all just sort of got used to Steve McQueen's 12 Years a Slave and the idea of the sexual politics of slavery, this really does look pretty tame. Mm. But for all that, and it's certainly very tame compared with Amar Asante's debut film 10 years ago, A Way of Life, which was sensationally incendiary and difficult film. She has, for career reasons, I don't know, wanted to show that she can take the helm of a trad movie, a movie that in which she may have some political or personal investment in, but nevertheless, she can take the helm of a trad movie and carry off a straight commercial picture. And she's certainly done that. So I didn't have a problem with it. It's nothing to set the pulses racing, but I thought it was a good watchable movie.
Andrew, did it set your pulse racing? There's an image, your pulse racing.
Yeah, well, you don't want to think about that. I'm very much with Peter. I mean, I did find it very enjoyable, very watchable, but very mainstream conventional the way it's filmed. I mean, it's a great cast. You know, Amar Asante's got some real sort of top pro people involved, like Tom Wilkinson, Emily Watson, etc. And they all do a sterling job. I suppose it is the sort of central figure is in such an unusual position, and there are lots of points to be made about the sort of position of of race in the late 18th century. And I will say, from looking up Dido Belle's story, it seems like it's not just the ending. I mean, a lot of things have been sort of heavily nudged by the filmmakers to sort of turn it into a sort of a trad rom-com. Not the least this Dido Belle's own interest in the fate of the Zong, which is this sort of notorious case of a slave ship, which sort of goes on in the background of this story, which, as far as I'm aware, she had no contact with.
But it did happen,
and the main character was, who was her sort of guardian, was involved in this judgment.
That's
so,
true enough.
So So I think it looks like they've nudged lots of things to sort of make it work in a very
But that's not a problem if this is a story absolutely. That we didn't really know about anyway.
Absolutely. But it's very watchable, and even the sort of more absurd rom-com elements, you know, like this very hunky firebrand guy she kind of falls in love with, you know, that's sort of straight out of the... you know, the Matthew McConaughey playbook on some level, but it works. You know, it sort of makes you watch it, even though something that you might have thought was going to be a bit of a dull history lesson type film, sort of takes fire on some level.
I thought it was also rather shrewd on the Zoffany portrait of the two women, Elizabeth and Belle, and how the film, as Santi gave us little glimpses of earlier portraits, which showed that there was a convention of showing these women waited on by a kind of Moor manservant, whatever. And the fact remains that this famous portrait is not, in fact, so different from those things, and that the two women are not fully side by side, in fact. That Belle appears to be a little bit further back and in a kind of slightly subservient position. And I think the film quite interestingly alluded to that Belle's reaction to this portrait was not, oh, yippee, what a wonderful portrait. It's saying, well, I seem to have taken second place a little bit in this picture, in this iconography.
We shall be receiving visitors for dinner.
Visitors? Whoever bothers to visit us here?
Or leave except the dead.
Once again, Dido.
Beds, Aunt Mary. We should prepare some extra beds in case our visitors are to stay.
May we wear the new silk?
I will do your hair, bed.
Oh, say we may wear them, Aunt Mary.
You will not be dining with us, Dido.
Of course. But I may join after dinner, may I not?
Yes, such are the rules, and you know them well.
An untold slice of history in Emma Asante's Belle. Next up, Devil's Knot, Atamagoyan's account of the West Memphis 3 murder case. And yes, admittedly, this history has been documented before, but never via the medium of Colin Firth.
We have three boys missing from Holiday Garden. It's a very delicate situation. I'm in the woods by that little creek they call Devil's Den. I found something.
The West Memphis 3 murder case galvanized Arkansas back in 1993 and sparked a series of investigative documentaries. Now along comes Colin Firth, Reese Witherspoon and director Atamagoyan to spin the tale as a procedural thriller. They're about to get lost in the woods.
This crime is unthinkable. What if they did it?
And what if they didn't? Did you kill any of those three boys?
No.
Anytime anything weird happens around here, people blame it on devil worship.
Andrew, we've had various documentaries, famously, about the West Memphis 3 murder case. Is Atamagoyan able to do anything different because by dint of this being a drama?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's a slightly difficult position for him to be in. When all the crusading has been done, obviously this was a horrible murder. What seemed to be a fairly gruesome miscarriage of justice as well. What I think Egoyan is trying to do is to examine it in a very neutral way, try and apportion no real weight as a filmmaker, to try and be an anti-crusader really, and try and understand what happened and how the miscarriage of justice happened, as well as the original murder. And I personally think it's sort of quite an interesting approach. It's a very sort of incurious eye that he lets loose on events. But on the other hand, there are obviously some awful scenes that a lot of people have sort of picked out, and particularly these kind of terrible glances that Colin Firth, who is utterly miscast. I mean, the guy is obviously a great actor, but I mean, why anybody thought he would convince as a private detective in Tennessee?
Or... And a lot of really stock courtroom scenes where the drama comes from people going in the gallery or shaking their head. Yeah.
And it's sort of strange for a director who is trying to make a very uninflected drama to suddenly use these real knee-jerk cliche moments. It's a kind of very jarring effect it has. So it has, for me, it was watchable because it just tried to cover every base and try and tell you about everything without coming to any conclusion, because the case is still totally unresolved.
Yeah.
There's like three or four different theories as to what might have happened.
Which is fine, but he doesn't really make a bonus of it. I mean, I had a similar problem with this that I did with his most recent film, Captives, that we saw in Cannes, that I thought, I'm not quite sure what you're doing here. Yeah. On the one hand, it's a really cliched CSI style, very flat procedural. and yet there's something kind of darker here that you're not quite tapping into. Yeah.
I found it absolutely insufferable. Absolutely insufferable. The four films, the four documentaries have done a superb job, and they really have. And for Atom of Goyen to show up grandly and say, stand aside, guys, I've got Colin Firth, I've got Reese Witherspoon, now we're going to do it for real. Absolutely appalling. The idea that Andrew may well be right. He's approaching this from a kind of neutral point of view and trying to see where the blame lies. The documentary makers have already done a darn good job of that. They've already shown, to my satisfaction and lots of other people, exactly what happened, exactly how it happened, exactly how the miscarriage of justice began to gain a sort of momentum, how that began to snowball, and who the guilty parties, in all probability, actually were. Those films had already done a huge amount of stunning work on this. And for Atom of Goyen to show up and conceitedly ladle on his own kind of auteur conceits on it, it's not quite as outrageous as what he did with The Captives, but I found this was utterly mediocre, especially as it's a live issue. It's not as if we don't know anything about it. These four films, the three films, certainly the original, the Paradise Lost films, are sensational pieces of documentary cinema. They're sensational pieces of pioneering investigative cinema. And for this, I don't know, frankly, rather fatuous piece of fictional cinema to show up and try to siphon off some of their achievement is sort of intolerable, really.
There was blood on the knife.
They will do anything to get people to say what they want to hear.
Killing 3 8-year-olds would make you feel good.
Whoever did it must have.
Satanism is out there.
Judge, everybody, this is all just some sort of game to them.
Atom of Goyen returns to the crime scene in Devil's Knot. We now move to an altogether more sunny stretch of America for the young and prodigious T.S. Spivet, Jean-Pierre Jeunet's tale of a young and prodigious little pioneer. His name is T.S. Spivet.
T.S. Spivet, your invention has won our prestigious Baird Award.
Wow. They think I'm an adult. This trip scares me, but that's that. I'm leaving tomorrow for Washington, D.C.
Jean-Pierre Jeunet lays on the candy floss for this tale of a lonesome, plucky, pint-sized genius who takes a trip across America. Helena Bonham Carter is Mom, left back home on the ranch in Montana and wondering just where he's at.
Take care, little guy.
Hey!
Hello, T.S.?
Yeah! Not sure what you're looking for, but don't change a thing. Steady in your boots.
Peter, how could you not be charmed by the young and prodigious T.S. Spivet?
Oh, my God, I don't want to be a grumpy person this week, but this film made me break out in a rash. I really found it intensely annoying. I remember when Jean-Pierre Jeunet made Amelie a long time ago now, it was a real novelty, and that, how shall I say, that precocious and slightly infantilized sensibility worked, I thought, well, and it was certainly very novel and unexpected and unusual at the time, with Audrey Tautou, this sweet, doe-eyed kind of gamine figure. And it's romantic. Yes, exactly. It's sort of precocious and on the spectrum in a way. Whereas with this little boy, there's just, it's the same thing again. It's basically the same thing again. It's intensely twee. It's intensely fey. It's affected. It has a tenuous relationship with reality.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem to be, it looks a
That's
bit like reality.
That's weird about
it. And it's very unreal. It doesn't seem to have, all right, okay, it's a fantasy, but it's not claiming to be a fantasy.
Yeah.
It's sort of claiming to be real life, in a way, because there is a very real life tragedy at the heart of it, and we are expected very seriously indeed to sympathise very much indeed.
And then there's a point where the kid, where he breaks his ribs, and you think, oh,
yeah.
Jesus, this is suddenly kind of serious. And yet the rest of it is this kind of weightless,
sweet,
wafting,
twee little fantasy, this sort of Euro-Americana that they've confected. And in that and many other ways, the film is trying to have its cake and eat it. It's trying to make you really upset and really fall in love with this character on a real level, but also stake some claim to some eerie, wonderful kind of sugary Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds sort of fantasy world. And I'm sorry, it just made me sort of throw up a bit. I don't want to be. I'm so miserable this week. I'm sorry. Forgive me.
Mrs. Gibson.
Mm-hmm.
Hello. I'm T.S. Spivet. I made it here.
You're the one I talked to on the phone last Friday.
Yes.
So where's your father?
In fact, he's dead. I lied to you then.
So who sent me the prototype of the magnetic wheel?
I did.
Oh. What, you expect me to believe that you invented it?
Not really. I didn't invent anything. I just transposed the principle of an electron gravitating around the nucleus.
But as you know, to simulate its perpetual motion would require the creation of a negative entropy, which is simply not possible. You must agree, all right?
This can't be. How old are you?
10.
10.
Oh! The sugar levels just keep on rising in the young and prodigious T.S. Spivitt. Just time for one last film, and hallelujah, it may just be the pick of the week. The cavalry's coming, and this is Of Horses and Men.
If you like big skies and small horses, vodka and sex, then your cup runneth over. Benedict Erlingsson's film is an oddball delight, a series of interlinking chapters that throws the animals and their owners into stark relief.
Andrew, this is sort of weird, but kind of wonderful.
Absolutely. I mean, this, as you said, is head and shoulders above everything else this week, I think. It's a very odd, strange film. It's a sort of collection of stories set in Iceland with different people who have their different relationships with their horses, who all these horses trot. They don't gallop. Mm-hmm. This is an Icelandic thing, I think. Right from the very first scene, there's an amazing scene of this man who's far too tall for the horse he's riding.
Yeah, his feet are almost dragging along the gravel.
And this horse is sort of trotting along like mad, and he's sort of like, it all kind of looks like something out of Monty Python.
Yeah, or Bernie Winters. Yeah,
but each of these stories have this, you know, some of them are kind of horrifically tragic, some of them are absurdly comic, and they all dwell on this relationship between people and their animals, and somehow they reflect the human relationship. Sometimes they, trigger other narratives and events. With, you know, it's just all sorts of things going on, and it's very intriguing and watchable. I mean, there's been quite a bunch of films coming out of Iceland recently. Some of them are clearly aimed to sort of break into Hollywood.
Yeah,
films like this ain't that jar. And this absolutely isn't. I mean, it's very much in the tradition of those very odd Euro art house films like that Goat documentary, whose name escapes me.
Oh yeah,
that kind of thing.
Travolta.
Yeah, that kind of, you know, where it's just, you know, this couldn't really come out of anywhere except this place, really.
And yeah, its localism is what makes it so appealing.
Yeah, it's totally in and of itself, of this certain place and certain time, I guess. I saw this last year for the first time in the San Sebastian Film Festival, and we were all of us kind of agog. We think, what the heck is this? Unbelievable. And this extraordinary behaviour of both the horses and the human beings, who genuinely seem to have equal time on screen. They're genuinely of equal importance.
Yeah.
And the interesting idea that the horses, they have feelings too, but they're not encumbered by the human need to conceal or displace their feelings. So they don't appear to have feelings at all, and yet it's the human beings who are the ones who are dysfunctional. Not the horses, obviously, even though the horses behave in this outrageous way.
Oh, yeah, they're kind of almost unwitting agents of chaos.
Yes,
aren't they?
The horses are, in a way, the horses are the language which allows the poor, messed-up humans to communicate with each other, in a way. I thought it was a terrific, terrific little film. It's not, maybe it's not a masterpiece, but my goodness, it is so distinctive and funny and weird. It is a real cult gem. I mean, it really is. It really is.
Of Horses and Men, sending us cantering towards the finish line. My thanks to Peter Bradshaw and Andrew Pulver for riding out with me. We've been rattled and wounded, but we got there in the end. Thanks for watching. We're back next week.